Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered. It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit DetectTheSOS.com today to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Tommy Tucker will be back tomorrow. I'm here today. I'm Dave Cohen. Thanks for joining us on WWL. It's a cold start out there for most of us. 33 now north of the lake, 41 at the airport. Still some dense fog reported with visibility down to a quarter of a mile in Hammond and Macomb, but most of the other areas, that overnight dense fog has been lifting. The Pew Research Center annually finds out how religious people in America are, and it looks like things have now stabilized. Back in 2020, they asked people if they attend religious services at least once or twice a month. And 33% of Americans said that they do, that they regularly go to a church, a synagogue, or some other house of worship. 34% said they do that in 2025. So you can see about a third of Americans over the last 5 years have consistently said that they regularly attend some sort of religious services. And what percentage of Americans identify with an organized religion? Well, it was 71% back in 2020. It's now 70% for 2025. To help us understand what's going on, and is this a stabilization where we've kind of reached an area where we know which Americans are actually participating in organized religion and which are not, we asked Mark Silk to join us, a professor emeritus of religion and public life at Trinity College. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing well. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. And 2 weeks to go. From today will be Christmas Eve. Are you surprised, or is that what you expected, that about one-third of Americans regularly attend some sort of religious services?
I think that's pretty believable. It's interesting. Back at the beginning of this century, so, 25 years ago, the questions that were always asked of that sort were, do you attend weekly? And the numbers were actually a little higher than they are now. So, we've sort of lowered the bar on what counts as regular attendance. And you have to, you have to also ask, you know, do people honestly say how often they attend? Sometimes people exaggerate what they consider to be their good behavior, like voting and worship attendance is one of those things. So it seems about right, probably a little high.
Yeah, it's like if you ask someone, hey, do you go to the public library? And people are like, oh, yeah, I go all the time, because they feel totally. Like it's something they're supposed to do. And it's probably the same, you're right, with asking people if they regularly attend religious services. But you make a very interesting point. Pew is now asking people, do you attend at least once or twice a month? It used to be expected that you attended every week. This nation was founded by those seeking to practice their religion freely and probably practiced it a whole lot more than we do these days. But the fact that it's stabilized over the last 5 years seems to indicate we've hit a plateau, right? And we kind of know. Now, that means 2/3 of Americans do not attend any religious services regularly.
That's right. And, you know, the other telling fact to me is the percentages of Americans who identify with a religion. And you know, back in the 1990s, you know, there were maybe 7% of Americans didn't. Now that number is well up in the 30s. And for the youngest generation, you know, Gen Z, the numbers are, you know, is north of 40. For people who say they don't, you know, they don't identify with religion, they're nuns. So that's been perhaps the most striking statistic about American religion over the past generation.
So for the last 5 years, it's been pretty stable that about 70% identify with a religion. But you're saying in the 20 or 30 years prior to that, that number was much higher. And so we've kind of seen a significant dip, but it seems like it's stabilized. We're not seeing a vast abandonment of people identifying with a religion, even though fewer and fewer are attending regular organized church, synagogue, or other religious services.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, one of the things that did interest me about the comparison that you're, you know, focused on is there doesn't seem to have been any particular impact of COVID, where, you know, an awful lot of Americans stopped showing up, you know, in person at religious services. And the impact of the pandemic seems to have been, you know, minimal, I guess.
Yeah, because I ask people if they attend. Now, they may still, I know a lot of houses of worship still Zoom or YouTube or Facebook Live their services. And I don't know if people answering that question feel like going on their tablet, laptop, or phone to attend a service or not. They didn't make that distinction.
Good question. Yeah. It would have been interesting if Pew had sort of tracked that. You know, and a lot of people go to big churches, and what they're watching when they sit there is a screen.
Good point. Yeah, because they're so far away from the pulpit that they have to watch it on a screen anyway to have a good view of whoever is doing the preaching. We're talking about religion in the United States. When we come back, we'll find out how many Americans say they pray daily and find out what that tells us about religion in the United States 2 weeks before Christmas Eve. Right now, we got to check WWL traffic. 2/3 of Americans surveyed by Pew say they do not attend a church, temple, mosque, or other house of worship even once a month anymore. Only 1/3 regularly go to services, and only 70% identify with a religion, way down from the 1990s. We're talking with Professor Emeritus of Religion in Public Life at Trinity College, Mark Silk. This Pew Research Study professor also asked people, do you pray daily? And 52% of Americans in 1990 said they did not pray daily. 54% in 2025 say they do not pray daily. More than half of Americans no longer pray every day. What does that tell you about the status of religion in our country?
Well, it says, you know, people are praying less. You know, it's pretty stable. I mean, you know, the real question that, you know, one has to ask about these things is what's happening with different groups of, you know, age cohorts. What do the trends look like over time? People who were born, you know, in the 1940s or 50s retain a lot of identification with religion. They pray a fair amount. They go to services, you know, regularly. But what's happening with Gen Z and, you know, so on? And there, you know, there has been some journalistic claims that may be stabilizing and turning around. But the overall trends are that young people, I mean, I'm looking at statistics from that report showing that, you know, only 7% of the youngest adults say they consider themselves very religious, and only 24% pray daily. So we've been looking at quite a decline in religious practice, the question there is, you know, has that stabilized? Is it going to turn around? Religion has had remarkable staying power over the millennia, but these are striking numbers.
Yeah, so based on the past, can we predict, do you think, the future? Is religion going to, while it stabilized the last 5 years, it looks like, based on the numbers of these younger people, do you expect that they will become more religious as they age, or are we going to see a continued decline to a point where we have less than a quarter of Americans soon who are attending regular services of any kind?
I think probably we are going to have less than around a quarter. Americans always look for revivals of religion, and that does happen in American and larger history. I think what's likely to happen is that you'll have a strong cohort, but a minority of Americans who take religion very seriously, and lots of people for whom it doesn't mean that much one way or another. They're not active atheists, or they don't think about it much. They just live their lives. They don't, you know, they'll probably show up at a house of worship for a wedding or a bath, you know, whatever.
Yeah, or maybe on Christmas Day, yeah, or Christmas Eve.
But yeah, something.
That's about
something
it.
Like that. But we're talking about norms in the society, and it's quite clear that people don't feel the sort of social pressure to just show up every week at church the way or other religious synagogue or mosque, you know, once upon a time that was the case.
Professor, we sure appreciate your getting up early and sharing your expertise with us here on WWL. Whatever it is that you choose to believe, celebrate, or whatever, I hope you have a wonderful season ahead. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Dave.
All right. Yeah. I'm Dave Cohen. We'll be back after this on WWL. Hearing from a number of people who have something to do with these lectures at bars. One person who is a bar owner calls it spot on. Another person says, these bar lectures are usually surprisingly entertaining. Experts in fields can sometimes be very funny when talking about their wheelhouse. And somebody else says that they've attended a series of bar lectures called Nerd Nights. You ever been to a lecture in a bar? I have not. And this trend has somehow escaped me. Now, I don't go to bars very often anymore at this stage in my life, but maybe I would if there was someone talking about something I wanted to hear. I'd go listen to Doug Cinceri give a lecture in a bar. He's host of All Things Legal here on WWL and joining us now. Good morning, Doug. How you doing?
Good morning. I think girls used to lecture me in bars to stay away about 40 years ago.
Yeah, you got lectured all the time in the bars. This is not the same kind of lecture. Yeah. I wanted to have you on this morning because I want to understand the law when it comes to immigration and public schools. We saw a report this week that 15%, that's a surprisingly large number, of students in Jefferson Parish public schools have not been attending school since the Border Patrol crackdown began here in the greater New Orleans region. Does that surprise you, 15%?
Yeah, I mean, especially Jefferson Parish, I had no idea that, to that extent that, there's that many, I guess, undocumented people whose children go to school.
Now, you and I haven't had kids in school in a while, but I do remember, my youngest is in his 20s now, but I do remember when we enrolled our kids in school, you needed to present a birth certificate. Is that right. No longer the case? Do you not need to establish residency or citizenship to send a child to school in Louisiana?
Well, there's a difference between residency and citizenship. You have to present documentation as to where you live, because under the Supreme Court case, Plyer versus Doe, you have to, school districts have to educate children who are residents, legal or illegal, within their district. Now, you have to present maybe a lease, a utility bill, or affidavit saying, I live in this district, for the purpose of determining you don't live in another district. Because the purpose is that district should be paying for its own schools, and you shouldn't be, you know, a district shouldn't be paying for a kid in another state or another district. So you have to present for the purposes of residency or where you live, but there's no requirement to produce a document saying that you are a legal citizen or a documented citizen of the United States. So there is a distinction there, but they basically have these requirements on two different train tracks. You don't have to prove that you're a legal resident in order to enroll in school in the United States. And in fact, you're not allowed to ask if you're a resident, a legal resident or not.
I thought you had to at least establish age.
You have to establish age.
So don't you need a birth certificate to establish age? Because I remember there was a cutoff. It was like a certain day in a certain month that established what grade you would go into, if you were old enough for kindergarten, first grade, whatever the question was. So I remember bringing a birth certificate to, I guess it was the school or the school board office. Again, this is ancient history for me. My kids are all grown. But if you need that birth certificate to prove age, doesn't that also establish citizenship?
Well, if you bring a birth certificate that shows age but is from another country, they cannot use that to exclude you into enrollment, you know, along with other documentation showing you live in the district. So if you have a birth certificate and it shows that you were born in Venezuela or South America, you can only use it for age to verify the age, but not to determine immigration status, and you cannot exclude them, a student, based on that fact. So yes, you do have to prove your age, and if you have to prove your age with a document from outside the country, that is okay, but they can't use that to exclude you into enrollment because they have doubts regarding your status as a citizen.
All right. So when we come back, I want to dig deeper into, does it seem like 15% of students in Jefferson Parish are undocumented children, or is it something maybe related to their parents, as many people are texting us? We'll talk to Doug Sinceri about that after we check on WWL Traffic. Attorney and host of All Things Legal, Doug Sinceri, told us a moment ago that precedent has established in the United States that schools cannot require proof of citizenship before enrolling students in a public school. What was the legal reasoning behind that precedent you cited?
I think they wanted to put a firewall between educating students and their parents' immigration status. In other words, public policy was, regardless of a child's parents' immigration status, if you live in a district, you must be educated.
So even if they entered the country illegally with their parents, or if they were born in the country or legal U.S. citizens, regardless, it doesn't matter. The policy of the United States, based on legal precedent, is everybody is entitled to an education regardless of the legality of their citizenship.
Absolutely.
All right. I wonder if that will be challenged at any point. We have seen a lot of other things challenged and precedents that have long stood in the United States being challenged, as we've seen a shift in public thought and the way people, their people's politics, that could be challenged, just like all of these other precedents we've seen challenged, right?
Yeah, I think it'd have to be addressed legislatively. And, you know, based on the composition of Congress right now, I don't think it would pass, or at least the Senate. So, and again, I think what the thought is, the children really, I mean, they found themselves where they were. I mean, they didn't make any decisions. There were decisions were being made for them, so they should not be penalized. And if they're here, whether they're legally or illegally or undocumented, they still need to be educated. And, you know, that is a, the consideration of the government at that point for the child who's, again, didn't make their own decisions.
A lot of people are texting us on the Equinor Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870, thinking that the 15% in Jefferson Parish that have not been attending school as we enter the second week of this Border Patrol crackdown on illegal immigration in Greater New Orleans may be partially due to the fact that the parents' immigration status is not legal, and that the parents are just essentially hiding in their homes and keeping their kids home during that process. I guess they could send them on a school bus, but clearly they don't want to drive to the school, fearing that immigration enforcement agents may be there and attempt to arrest them when they arrive, dropping their kids off.
Right. I think some of it may be unwarranted fear, I guess, as far as the law is concerned, but some of it is if they've identified someone who is the ICE is interested in and apprehending, they would maybe look up the school records and say this would be an opportunity to apprehend them because we know that they may be at the school at a certain time and certain place when they drop off their children. So that would be the conditions I would guess that they would fear. But as far as being turned in by the school or having some type of, review of the school records to determine whether there's an immigration status or implication that they're not, that's not the case. It would be that maybe that particular person of interest would be at could be identified at dropping off their children at a school at a certain time, and it would be easy to apprehend.
We look forward to hearing. You're going to be on this Sunday morning from 8 to 10 on WWL, huh?
That's right. The Saints play at 3:25, so we're on this Sunday. So it's our last show of the year.
We'll look forward
to January.
Yeah, yes. And then the Saints won't be in the playoffs, so you'll have regular shows again.
That's right. We're starting way too early this year. So
yeah, sad but true. All right.
That's right.
Thank you for lending your expertise, Doug. We look forward to hearing you Sunday morning at 8 a.m. All things legal here on WWL. All right, coming up. Big, big subsidies coming to farmers in the United States. We'll find out how that helps those growing crops and other agricultural interests here in Louisiana after the news on WWL. 8:15, thanks for joining us, spending your Wednesday with us. And we want to thank Ronald Surpass for always joining us, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning, Tom. I'm sorry. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
You're used to talking to Tommy, so it's okay. It's like suddenly they switch your spouse on you, and you're like, wait, what's going on here?
Yeah, but you're easy to spot because you're taller.
A little bit taller than Tommy, yeah. We're now counting down the days. Finally, we're getting to a point where we can actually see the end in sight for the Cantrell administration and the beginning of the Moreno administration. Although, under the Cantrell administration, somehow we saw remarkable crime reduction in the city of New Orleans. And I was thinking, and you don't have to comment politically, but tell me logistically what you think about the fact that we're going from a mayor who was largely absent, uninvolved, fighting battles, and not seemingly a real part of the day-to-day operations, yet we saw a police chief come in and was able to greatly reduce crime in the Crescent City. What happens, do you think, going forward when we have an involved mayor who is going to be goal-oriented and focused on helping this police chief continue the progress we've seen?
Well, I think one thing to say about the Cantrell administration is even before she was engaged in so much misconduct that produced a tremendous amount of distraction in her office, I'm not sure she had a whole lot to do with the police department anyway, just from the word on the street. Secondly, crime waves come and go, and there's oftentimes a lot of truth to that. And then also, chiefs can make a difference, but chiefs by themselves can't make all the difference. They need an active mayor. They need an active public support network through community groups, through relationships with the religious business community, et cetera. So the more of that goes on, the more likely a chief can be successful, and we should hope for that for the incoming mayor and the Chief Kirkpatrick. Whenever you have a circumstance where the mayor can help you kind of work through the political process, which is necessary to the work, you have a better outcome for opportunity for success.
Yeah, I just got to imagine that with it, kind of like the tush push that the Philadelphia Eagles are so successful with, when everybody, all 11 players, are pushing all at once in the same direction, you have amazing results. And I just got to imagine with the incoming mayor, we're going to see far more of that mentality towards the fight against crime and everyone on the same team pushing all in the same direction and all being involved in the play.
Well, I think a good example there isn't just the measure of crime, but I worked for Governor Locke, I worked for Mayor Purcell, and I worked for Mayor Dean. All three of those leaders went through dramatic budget, earth-shattering crises. They never wavered from the all hands on deck to hire police officers. Mayor Landrieu had a different set of circumstances or a different set of perceptions. But when the world went broke in 2008, Mayor Purcell did not say, we're going to stop hiring police. It is the mission of the mayor to support the police in hiring. So one of the key things Mayor Marino might have to consider is the model of Governor Locke, Mayor Purcell, Mayor Dean, who said, I know we got financial problems. I know we have issues that we have to confront that are very significant. But if we let a police department fall from 1,600 people in 2010 to 900 or less in 2025, the chances of any chief being successful is literally cut dramatically because you don't have enough people to get the job done. So that's one thing that the governor and two mayors I worked for, they were crystal clear. Yeah, the dot-com bust, state of Washington is going broke. You're going to hire troopers. You've got to get this done. So that might be a good change to have that kind of all on board tush-push for hiring.
Yeah, and we've already seen that Mayor-elect Moreno did in the budget process make sure there is significant overtime money actually in the budget for next year and is being able to prioritize public safety even at a time when the city is going to have a lot of pains budgetarily and there are going to be a lot of programs that don't get funded. It seems like anyway at this point that will be the case. So I guess there is hope that we can see this continued fight against crime and with this police chief vowing to stay on the job and get the job done. I guess we should be optimistic for continued crime reduction. But you pointed out earlier, sometimes there's factors outside of the control of a police chief, a mayor, or anyone else where we see these cyclical changes in crime, regardless of the efforts to fight it.
No, that's always the case. And now that they have a little more clarity on overtime, the police department even has a greater responsibility to deal openly, effectively, and transparently what is going to be more than one really critical report that's been bubbling in the news about the lack of control of overtime in the police department as a question. So let's see what those reports say from the Louisiana Auditor and the Office of Inspector General, because that will help frame the debate in the mind of the community, is this money being properly managed. And that's crucially as important as anything else you can do as chief.
We're talking with Ronald Surpass. Historically low crime now in New Orleans. Let's hope it continues. When we come back, now that the consent decree is over, who is going to monitor and can they effectively monitor the NOPD to make sure we continue to see effective constitutional policing? And
you open the fridge, there's nothing there. So what's it going to be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-through burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein. No artificial flavors or colors. No chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Ah, DSW, birthplace of the humble brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands. Or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. It's about getting the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. And to find candidates who match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Stop struggling to get your job post even seen on other sites. Give your job the best chance to be seen with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. They help you stand out and hire quality candidates who can drive the results you need. Sponsored Jobs boost your post for quality candidates, so you can reach the exact people you you want faster. Join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed-sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So that means a half day. Yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
And accountability within the police department, even though the Justice Department and a federal judge won't be watching over their shoulder. Let's check in with WWL traffic first. Talking with former NOPD chief, now professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, Ronald Surpass, about crime in the Crescent City. And we want to spend a couple of minutes on now what. With the NOPD transitioning out of the consent decree, what assurances do we have other than a statement from the police chief that there will be strict guardrails in place to make sure that the NOPD is compliant with the Constitution and current practices? What do you expect to see going forward?
Well, we thought about this back in 2010, 11, and 12 when we were putting this together. The only logical and already existing well-staffed unit that has trained investigators, has audit capacity, has trained experienced auditors, legal advisors, and such, is the Inspector General. There's no question that we knew back then that when the monitors left, and Arony left a 45-page memo to the court when they vacated the consent decree last week. And in the area of civilian monitoring and external audits, he writes what to me looks exactly like the job description of the independent the Inspector General. It's a good thing that the city of New Orleans already has an established Inspector General office that's created a level of trust and confidence in the government and, more importantly, in the community. But here's the key. When the OIG was created, the consent decree wasn't in place yet. The OIG is funded at a certain level with a lot of duties in other agencies to audit, inspect, evaluate, and control audits, which is what they exactly have to do for the police department. They're going to have to get more funding, because now that they have this consent decree closed, the only option is to assign all of these duties outlined by Arony in the clear what needs to be done, as outlined by Chief Kirkpatrick last week, what needs to be done. The OIG is the answer, only the OIG. They have the requisite experience, skills, auditing capacity. They are the choice, and that's what we thought about all along, is that it would be the OIG's office. And I hope that's what happens, because then you can continue to see independent external audits and review of what the department's doing to maintain its status. That's the answer.
Yeah, but you make the point that they need more money, and the one thing the city does not have right now is more money.
Well, you can't ask them to do what they've been doing, knowing that one day they're going to have to do this as well, and they should do this as well. And it's, you know, in the big scheme of things, it's not a tremendous amount of money, I'm sure, but they should do it, and it shouldn't be a matter of money. Somebody's got to do it anyway. Let them do it.
Chief Surpass, we always appreciate your expertise and your insight. We look forward to talking to you next week. I hope that, 2 weeks from today is Christmas Eve, so.
Great times. I hope you have a wonderful holidays.
You too. Enjoy the season. Chief Ronald Surpass here on WWL. Why do people quit jobs? And why don't they? A new report is out on a surprisingly large number of people who want to change jobs but don't. And I'll tell you why coming up. And I also want to talk to you. 504-260-1870. Do you want to change jobs, and is there something keeping you from doing it? We'll talk about it after this on WWL. Surveys find that 41% of Americans feel stuck in their job. It's for a variety of reasons, but the number one reason people say that they don't leave their current job is because they don't want to lose their employer-sponsored health care benefits. Half of people say they'd love to start their own business, but don't because they can't afford the health care and the health insurance costs that would come with being self-employed. Do you feel stuck in your job? We do our jobs more than we do anything else in life, right? I mean, I don't know anyone who actually works just 9 to 5 anymore. So we're at work more than we're awake at home in most cases. We're at work more than we're asleep in most cases. So for most people, they spend the greatest percentage of their time at their job, whatever it is. And I think it is absolutely unacceptable to be miserable in your job, because that's going to dictate how you feel generally in life. Are you amongst the 41% who feel stuck at your job? And if so, why? Call me now, 504-260-1870. I'd like to talk to you about it and find out what it is that is really preventing you. 4 out of 10 people want to have another job but feel like they can't do it. Half want to start their own jobs, their own businesses, and feel like they can't do it. One person texts us on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. Says, I don't understand why these people who want to start their own business don't. Do it on the side while staying with your job that's providing you with health insurance. A lot of people do have side hustles. In fact, I think more people than ever before have a side hustle now, have some other revenue stream, some other income, hopefully doing something that they like doing to try and augment what they get paid in their main job. And I think this texter has a point that if you start something as a side hustle, it doesn't mean it has to stay a side hustle. You can grow and evolve that to a point where if it gets big enough, it can become your main source of income. But you still have that question out there, well, then what do you do about health insurance? Particularly if you have a family and dependents who need your health care coverage to stay healthy and to get treatment when they need it. Somebody else texts us and says the government already has a model for universal health care. It's called the VA. It's a model that really should be looked at. I have a son-in-law who's a veteran, and he and my daughter and their family use the VA, and it has been very successful for him. But I don't know if there's a good model for universal health care that has worked in the United States or elsewhere that could be applied here. We hear that people of means in Canada come to the United States to get their health care because of the deficiencies in the universal health care program north of the border. To me, that's indicative of the fact that it won't work here, and there will be extremely long waits, and people will have trouble getting the care and coverage that they need in a massive system here. But we also know that what we have now for healthcare is not working, that it's way too expensive, and we still have problems with waiting way too long to get care and difficulties in many times getting the medications or procedures that we need because it's dictated by someone other than a doctor on what you can take and how you can be treated. We'll continue the conversation after we check on WWL traffic. So I've done some deeper digging into this report that 41% of Americans say they feel stuck in their jobs, and it gets even worse. According to the Overture Group, a search and compensation consulting firm, roughly 69% of the American workforce, more than two-thirds, is either not engaged or is actively disengaged from their work. That people are so miserable at their jobs that they have no passion for the job that they have right now, that they're not doing it with any enthusiasm at all. 69% is either not engaged or actively disengaged from their work. Millions and millions of Americans hate their jobs. And that, to me, is a tragedy. And it's fear, they say, that overwhelmingly keeps people in jobs that they hate. Fear of stepping out and trying something new. Fear of starting a job search and their employer finding out and them losing their job before they find another one. Fear that they won't be able to make as much money or have as good health insurance. A lot of things that they fear. But I just can't imagine, and I feel very fortunate to be in the 31% of Americans that are still engaged in, actively, and do love their job. But to me, that is a sad, sad statement on the statement on the situation that we're facing as an American workforce. If 69% of people essentially don't care or really hate their jobs, that is not sustainable. And that's not good for us as a society. And that explains why people have bad customer service experiences, bad product experiences, and bad coworker experiences across the board more and more. It's because you can't be good at your job if you don't like it or if you hate it. So I want to continue this conversation into the next half hour after the news. I want you to call me, 504-260-1870. Do you work with people who hate working where you work? And does that make your job more difficult? Are you amongst the 69% that do hate or are just not engaged in, just don't care about their job at all? Or are you amongst the 31% who still are passionate for and love your job? If you're in that group, I think you should count yourself as very fortunate, because could you imagine having to get up out of bed? And obviously a lot of you can. Get out of bed every day to go do a job that you either don't care about or absolutely hate. That's got to ruin everything else in your life. How do you find happiness elsewhere in your life if you're miserable at work? Let's talk about it next half hour here on WWL. 8:15, thanks for joining us, spending your Wednesday with us. And we want to thank Ronald Surpass for always joining us, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
You're used to talking to Tommy, so it's okay. It's like suddenly they switch your spouse on you, and you're like, wait, what's going on here?
Yeah, but you're easy to spot because you're taller.
A little bit taller than Tommy, yeah. We're now counting down the days. Finally, we're getting to a point where we can actually see the end in sight for the Cantrell administration and the beginning of the Moreno administration. Although, under the Cantrell administration, somehow we saw remarkable crime reduction in the city of New Orleans. And I was thinking, and you don't have to comment politically, but tell me logistically what you think about the fact that we're going from a mayor who was largely absent, uninvolved, fighting battles, and not seemingly a real part of the day-to-day operations, yet we saw a police chief come in and was able to greatly reduce crime in the Crescent City. What happens, do you think, going forward when we have an involved mayor who is going to be goal-oriented and focused on helping this police chief continue the progress we've seen?
Well, I think one thing to say about the Cantrell administration is even before she was engaged in so much misconduct that produced a tremendous amount of distraction in her office, I'm not sure she had a whole lot to do with the police department anyway, just from the word on the street. Secondly, crime waves come and go, and there's oftentimes a lot of truth to that. And then also, chiefs can make a difference, but chiefs by themselves can't make all the difference. They need an active mayor. They need an active public support network through community groups, through relationships with the religious business community, et cetera. So the more of that goes on, the more likely a chief can be successful, and we should hope for that for the incoming mayor and the Chief Kirkpatrick. Whenever you have a circumstance where the mayor can help you kind of work through the political process, which is necessary to the work, you have a better outcome for opportunity for success.
Yeah, I just got to imagine that with it, kind of like the tush push that the Philadelphia Eagles are so successful with, when everybody, all 11 players, are pushing all at once in the same direction, you have amazing results. And I just got to imagine with the incoming mayor, we're going to see far more of that mentality towards the fight against crime and everyone on the same team pushing all in the same direction and all being involved in the play.
Well, I think a good example there isn't just the measure of crime, but I worked for Governor Locke, I worked for Mayor Purcell, and I worked for Mayor Dean. All three of those leaders went through dramatic budget, earth-shattering crises. They never wavered from the all hands on deck to hire police officers. Mayor Landrieu had a different set of circumstances or a different set of perceptions. But when the world went broke in 2008, Mayor Purcell did not say, we're going to stop hiring police. It is the mission of the mayor to support the police in hiring. So one of the key things Mayor Moreno might have to consider is the model of Governor Locke, Mayor Purcell, Mayor Dean, who said, I know we got financial problems. I know we have issues that we have to confront that are very significant. But if we let a police department fall from 1,600 people in 2010 to 900 or less in 2025, the chances of any chief being successful is literally cut dramatically because you don't have enough people to get the job done. So that's one thing that the governor and two mayors I worked for, they were crystal clear. Yeah, the dot-com bust, state of Washington is going broke. You're going to hire troopers. You've got to get this done. So that might be a good change to have that kind of all on board push for hiring.
Yeah, and we've already seen that Mayor-elect Moreno did in the budget process make sure there is significant overtime money actually in the budget for next year and is being able to prioritize public safety even at a time when the city is going to have a lot of pains budgetarily and there are going to be a lot of programs that don't get funded. It seems like anyway at this point that will be the case. So I guess there is hope that we can see this continued fight against crime and with this police chief vowing to stay on the job and get the job done. I guess we should be optimistic for continued crime reduction. But you pointed out earlier, sometimes there's factors outside of the control of a police chief, a mayor, or anyone else where we see these cyclical changes in crime, regardless of the efforts to fight it.
No, that's always the case. And now that they have a little more clarity on overtime, the police department even has a greater responsibility to deal openly, effectively, and transparently what is going to be more than one really critical report that's been bubbling in the news about the lack of control of overtime in the police department as a question. So let's see what those reports say from the Louisiana Auditor and the Office of Inspector General, because that will help frame the debate in the mind of the community, is this money being properly managed. And that's crucially as important as anything else you can do as chief.
We're talking with Ronald Surpass. Historically low crime now in New Orleans. Let's hope it continues. When we come back, now that the consent decree is over, who is going to monitor and can they effectively monitor the NOPD to make sure we continue to see effective constitutional policing and accountability within the police department, even though the Justice Department and a federal judge won't be watching over their shoulder? Let's check in with WWL traffic first. Talking with former NOPD chief, now professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, Ronald Surpass, about crime in the Crescent City. And we want to spend a couple of minutes on now what. With the NOPD transitioning out of the consent decree, what assurances do we have other than a statement from the police chief that there will be strict guardrails in place to make sure that the NOPD is compliant with the Constitution and current practices? What do you expect to see going forward?
Well, we thought about this back in 2010, 11, and 12 when we were putting this together. The only logical and already existing well-staffed unit that has trained investigators, has audit capacity, has trained, experienced auditors, legal advisors, and such, is the Inspector General. There's no question that we knew back then that when the monitors left, and Arony left a 45-page memo to the court when they vacated the consent decree last week, and in the area of civilian monitoring and external audits, he writes what to me looks exactly like the job description of the independent of the Inspector General. It's a good thing that the city of New Orleans already has an established Inspector General office that's created a level of trust and confidence in the government and, more importantly, in the community. But here's the key. When the OIG was created, the consent decree wasn't in place yet. The OIG is funded at a certain level with a lot of duties in other agencies to audit, inspect, evaluate, and control audits, which is what they exactly have to do for the police department. They're going to have to get more funding because now that they have this consent decree closed, the only option is to assign all of these duties outlined by Arony in the clear what needs to be done, as outlined by Chief Kirkpatrick last week, what needs to be done. The OIG is the answer, only the OIG. They have the requisite experience, skills, auditing capacity. They are the choice, and that's what we thought about all along, is that it would be the OIG's office. And I hope that's what happens, because then you can continue to see independent external audits and review of what the department's doing to maintain its status. That's the answer.
Yeah, but you make the point that they need more money, and the one thing the city does not have right now is more money.
Well, you can't ask them to do what they've been doing, knowing that one day they're going to have to do this as well, and they should do this as well. And it's, you know, in the big scheme of things, it's not a tremendous amount of money, I'm sure, but they should do it, and it shouldn't be a matter of money. Somebody's got to do it anyway. Let them do it.
Chief Serpas, we always appreciate your expertise and your insight. We look forward to talking to you next week. I hope that, 2 weeks from today is Christmas Eve, so.
Great times. I hope you have a wonderful holidays.
You too. Enjoy the season. Chief Ronald Serpas here on WWL. Why do people quit jobs? And why don't they? A new report is out on a surprisingly large number of people who want to change jobs, but don't. And I'll tell you why coming up. And I also want to talk to you. 504-260-1870. Do you want to change jobs? And is there something keeping you from doing it? We'll talk about it after this on WWL. Surveys find that 41% of Americans feel stuck in their job. It's for a variety of reasons, but the number one reason people say that they don't leave their current job.
You open the fridge, there's nothing there. So what's it going to be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-through burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein, no artificial flavors or colors, no chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Come to DSW for the shoes, stay for the fun. Because let's be honest, if shoe shopping isn't fun, are you even doing it right? So go ahead, try something new. Try something different. Good different. Try something that feels like you. You know, the real you. And then definitely brag about it later. Because at DSW, you've got unlimited freedom to play. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. It's about getting the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. And to find candidates who match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Stop struggling to get your job post even seen on other sites. Give your job the best chance to be seen with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. They help you stand out and hire quality candidates who can drive the results you need. Sponsored Jobs boost your post for quality candidates so you can reach the exact people you want faster. Join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here for Mint Mobile. You know, one of the perks about having four kids that you know about is actually getting a direct line to the big man up north. Mm-hmm. And this year, he wants you to know the best gift that you can give someone is the gift of Mint Mobile's unlimited wireless for $15 a month. Now, you don't even need to wrap it. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Job is because they don't want to lose their employer sponsored health care benefits. Half of people say they'd love to start their own business, but don't because they can't afford the health care and the health insurance costs that would come with being self employed. Do you feel stuck in your job? We do our jobs more than we do anything else in life, right? I mean, I don't know anyone who actually works just 9 to 5 anymore. So we're at work more than we're awake at home in most cases. We're at work more than we're asleep in most cases. So for most people, they spend the greatest percentage of their time at their job, whatever it is. And I think it is absolutely unacceptable to be miserable in your job, because that's going to dictate how you feel generally in life. Are you amongst the 41% who feel stuck at your job? And if so, why? Call me now, 504-260-1870. I'd like to talk to you about it and find out what it is that is really preventing you. 4 out of 10 people want to have another job but feel like they can't do it. Half want to start their own jobs, their own businesses, and feel like they can't do it. One person texts us on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. Says, I don't understand why these people who want to start their own business don't. Do it on the side while staying with your job that's providing you with health insurance. A lot of people do have side hustles. In fact, I think more people than ever before have a side hustle now, have some other revenue stream, some other income, hopefully doing something that they like doing to try and augment what they get paid in their main job. And I think this texter has a point that if you start something as a side hustle, it doesn't mean it has to stay a side hustle. You can grow and evolve that to a point where if it gets big enough, it can become your main source of income. But you still have that question out there, well, then what do you do about health insurance? Particularly if you have a family and dependents who need your health care coverage to stay healthy and to get treatment when they need it. Somebody else texts us and says the government already has a model for universal health care. It's called the VA. It's a model that really should be looked at. I have a son-in-law who's a veteran, and he and my daughter and their family use the VA, and it has been very successful for him. But I don't know if there's a good model for universal health care that has worked in the United States or elsewhere that could be applied here. We hear that people of means in Canada come to the United States to get their health care because of the deficiencies in the universal health care program north of the border. To me, that's indicative of the fact that it won't work here, and there will be extremely long waits, and people will have trouble getting the care and coverage that they need in a massive system here. But we also know that what we have now for healthcare is not working, that it's way too expensive, and we still have problems with waiting way too long to get care and difficulties in many times getting the medications or procedures that we need because it's dictated by someone other than a doctor on what you can take and how you can be treated. We'll continue the conversation after we check on WWL traffic. So I've done some deeper digging into this report that 41% of Americans say they feel stuck in their jobs, and it gets even worse. According to the Overture Group, a search and compensation consulting firm, roughly 69% of the American workforce, more than two-thirds, is either not engaged or is actively disengaged from their work. That people are so miserable at their jobs that they have no passion for the job that they have right now, that they're not doing it with any enthusiasm at all. 69% is either not engaged or actively disengaged from their work. Millions and millions of Americans hate their jobs. And that, to me, is a tragedy. And it's fear, they say, that overwhelmingly keeps people in jobs that they hate. Fear of stepping out and trying something new. Fear of starting a job search and their employer finding out and them losing their job before they find another one. Fear that they won't be able to make as much money or have as good health insurance. A lot of things that they fear. But I just can't imagine, and I feel very fortunate to be in the 31% of Americans that are still engaged in, actively, and do love their job. But to me, that is a sad, sad statement on the statement on the situation that we're facing as an American workforce. If 69% of people essentially don't care or really hate their jobs, that is not sustainable. And that's not good for us as a society. And that explains why people have bad customer service experiences, bad product experiences, and bad coworker experiences across the board more and more. It's because you can't be good at your job if you don't like it or if you hate it. So I want to continue this conversation into the next half hour after the news. I want you to call me, 504-260-1870. Do you work with people who hate working where you work? And does that make your job more difficult? Are you amongst the 69% that do hate or are just not engaged in, just don't care about their job at all? Or are you amongst the 31% who still are passionate for and love your job? If you're in that group, I think you should count yourself as very fortunate, because could you imagine having to get up out of bed? And obviously a lot of you can. Get out of bed every day to go do a job that you either don't care about or absolutely hate. That's got to ruin everything else in your life. How do you find happiness elsewhere in your life if you're miserable at work? Let's talk about it next half hour here on WWL. Yeah, we went from the great resignation to suddenly the great stuck in a job that you hate. We'll pick up the conversation on this topic in just a moment. But right now, I want to welcome in Tim Brando of Fox Sports, who was had some conflicts with scheduling, but has worked us in. And I sure do appreciate that, Tim. How you doing?
I'm good, David. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on. And my apologies for some of that confusion. But hey, it's the holidays and things happen domestically from time to time, but I'm good.
Things happen domestically from time to time. No truer words have ever been spoken. From a great sports mind comes a philosophy for life from Tim Brando. Tim, I wanted to have you on today because I really was surprised at first by the large number of college football teams that have been refusing bids and invitations to play in games that aren't part of the playoff system. But then I got to thinking about it. We don't do this in any other sport. It's only in football where we have these lanyap extra games after the season's over that really are not meaningful in terms of standings or records or anything else, but they are profitable and they are fun and they have been historically rewarding. But now, so many teams are going, no, we don't want to do that. Baseball, you either go to the College World Series or you go home. Basketball, you either go to the Big Dance or the NIT or you go home. In football, we had these extraneous games, and now increasingly teams don't want to participate. What's up with that?
Well, it's a byproduct of what has happened with regard to the college game, college football in particular, trying to have what is, in fact, a far more American approach to its postseason, which is a playoff. That's what we have also in every other sport. You talk about the unique aspects of college football that are different than the other sports, and that's never been more true, and it's been true historically. We used to determine the national champions before, in my lifetime, before the bowl games ever took place. Famously in 1969, right after the 68 election, Richard Nixon brought the Associated Press National Championship Trophy to Texas after they beat Arkansas in what was deemed the game of the century when I was 12 years old. And I, you know, you look back on that, Notre Dame would then later play Texas in the Cotton Bowl, and it wouldn't have mattered had Notre Dame won. Texas still would have been national champions. Now, Texas did win the game, but that's we've really evolved a great deal in the 40 years that I've been doing this, starting at ESPN in 85 when I left Louisiana, and now 40 years later at Fox, where I currently reside and have been for 12 years. The bottom line is we have improved in terms of trying to determine what has always been a mythical national championship in college football. We have always had true national champions through a tournament in basketball with the NCAA tournament. College football is not under the jurisdiction of the NCAA monetarily whatsoever. There was a lawsuit brought in 1984 by the universities of Oklahoma and Georgia, which was won in the Supreme Court, which changed college football forever. In those days, only a couple of games were ever seen nationally, and they were all on ABC. We have now this proliferation of games through cable television and now digital. And we have networks now named after conferences that are on cable television.
That is so wild when you think about it.
A lot has changed.
An SEC network. It is kind of wild compared to just a couple of generations ago.
And an ACC network, which by the way, is in business, at least partially, with Notre Dame. Notre Dame has a business agreement to play five ACC teams per year and then compete in every other sport within the confines of the ACC, and yet they remain independent in college football. Now, you go figure all this out. I mean, if someone were coming in from another planet and they were trying to survey the sports landscape, they would say, what in the hell has been going on in college football? Because it really has been flying in different directions without much navigation for a long, long time. I would tell you that so much of what's happened here with the bowl situation and with Notre Dame not participating and saying, no, we're not, is based on really the flaws within the system of choosing the 12 teams that are going to play for the college football playoff. And we are in our infancy in terms of 12 teams, because this is only the second year that that's happened. And when Notre Dame, after winning 10 consecutive games, was left out in favor, really, of Alabama, who was playing in an SEC championship game and lost by a lot to Georgia, and did not move at all, stayed right where they were, then the committee decided to flip-flop Miami, which is an ACC full member, for Notre Dame, and Notre Dame was left out. So obviously the Irish and their leadership are very upset, and their players, now players are, as you know, being compensated, and they are getting ready for what's next in their careers. Their veteran players are getting ready for NFL combines, and they want to protect themselves. They don't want to get hurt. And so, so
Notre Dame doing it out of protest and to protect players. But what about the Kansas State, Kansas, Iowa State, Florida State, Auburn, UCF, Baylor, Rutgers, Temple?
Sure.
I mean, they're all not participating
for a variety of reasons. Mostly because of coaching changes. You got brand new coaches coming in to places like Kansas State and Iowa State, because the Penn State coach is now the former Iowa State coach. The Kansas State coach suddenly determined he would retire, which meant the Texas A&M offensive coordinator Colin Klein is going back to his alma mater to coach. And we also have, and this is another thing you've got to consider, David, is that we are in a situation now with regard to the college football playoff and the bowl system, that compensation for players also means they've got to make determinations on whether they are going to stay with a given school or transfer through the transfer portal. And that transfer portal date is now. It's in December. So they're making decisions. Most of these players are making decisions on where they're going to play next year. They're not necessarily going to stay, take their final exams, have a Christmas break like everybody else, and then come back for the next semester. No, they are going to be transferring, and they've got to make a determination where they're going to go in the portal. And then you have National Signing Day, which comes in early January. So coaches and players are making major decisions about their short-term futures at a time when bowl bids are being delivered after the college football reveal of those teams getting in the playoff and those teams going to bowl games would be announced. It has been mentioned that somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 to $60 million in losses could be incurred by the bowl system because of these big exits. Notre Dame brings a lot of eyeballs to games. Had they played BYU, yes, it's a glorified exhibition. It really doesn't mean anything. It's not a part of the playoff because those teams are not in it. But at the same time, even though it's a quality television show for ESPN, it doesn't mean anything. But the team that's replacing Notre Dame is not going to attract the same audience that Notre Dame would have. So it's got physical ramifications on college football, without a doubt. We're in the middle of seeing a situation where we've got to blow up a failed, flawed system on how we're determining which teams are going into this CFP. And then we have to find a way, if there is one, to save the bowls in and of themselves. I personally believe the way to go is for these people that are advertising on bowls and these people that are in communities like my own in Shreveport, where I'm from, born and raised. The Independence Bowl has been around longer than only 10 other bowls. But our game in our community is one that means a great deal to a lot of people. Same would be true for a lot of other bowl sites in this country. I think the best thing to do would be to get rid of bowls and move them to the very beginning of the season. And have the first week of games have matchups, intersectional matchups, that could be sponsored by bowls around the country as an introductory week into college football. Right now we call it week zero. Why do we call it week zero? Why don't we just call it bowl week? We'll have games involving teams in neutral sites to start the season before they actually start playing in their home field.
Yeah, we've seen LSU do this for years, but yeah, let's expand it. Across college football, have the bowls before the season. That is interesting, because that was my next question, was where do we go from here? Yeah. And do you expect, if we don't do something like that, then more and more teams that don't make the playoffs will refuse to participate? And can we go more than 12 teams? Clearly, we can't go 64 like basketball, because you can't play
that
many football.
16. We're going to go to 16, and we may go to 16 as soon as next year. And my guess is, The problem here is the powers that be, the commissioners of the conferences, because as I said before, the NCAA sanctions bowl games, okay, for some strange reason. They don't need to. We need the people that govern college football to make all college football decisions. As I said, the NCAA does not have any jurisdiction, and nor does it have reap any financial benefit from college football. And yet, for some reason, the presidents of these schools want them to be in charge of policing. And by the way, they don't do a very good job of it. Two, and then they want them to set the dates for the portal and for the signing dates, which are the absolute worst times for the portal dates and the signing dates to come up. We've got teams and players that are going to be playing in this playoff that also are trying to determine where they're going to play football next year.
We saw what happened with Ole Miss and LSU.
What? That's Exhibit A right there. That's Exhibit A. The coach that's about to take his team into the playoff to participate for a national championship is torn to such a degree that he walks away from his team, albeit for him a great opportunity. That's wrong. That's fundamentally wrong. We need to fix that. Okay. Some can be critical of Lane. Certainly I have been in spots, but I understand why he was in the situation he was in.
But he never should have been in that situation. Yeah. I mean,
exactly. We need to stop that. We need to fix that. And the best way to do it is to get the NCAA the hell out of college football altogether. And if the leaders of the sport, and when I say leaders, I mean the commissioners of the conferences, particularly the four power conferences, if they don't get together and start working in unison for the good of the game, not just for the good of their constituency, we're going to see this thing just flying out of control, and we're going to see some fan revolt to it. We are, because fans see what's going on. It's pretty obvious to them.
Tim Brando, I really appreciate your carving out some time for us and joining us. Fox Sports NFL and college football commentator, Louisiana native, and always always a friend of WWL. We appreciate your kind of painting the picture of this huge mess we're in, and we'll have to see if we can find our way out of it.
Well, I'm happy to do it. Thank my wife, too.
All right. Thank you, Mrs. Brando. We appreciate it.
We'll see you.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks, Tim. Yeah, what do we do? Because if we don't go to a 16-game playoff, and are the bowls dead? Are these meaningless bowls that happen outside of the playoff system going to just wither on the vine and die with more and more teams refusing to participate for a variety of reasons? Is it going to turn into more of what we see in other sports? I don't know, but I know it's a big mess, and we'll see. They keep trying different things in college football, and it seems the mess just keeps getting messier. We'll continue this conversation if you want to talk about people hating their jobs after this. You know, the college football, everything in college football just keeps getting murkier and muddier and messier. When you add in, okay, we're going to have players get paid now through the name, image, and likeness scene and scenario. And so now you have schools scrambling to get on board with that and find ways to get the NIL money to promise players big, big paychecks to come play at their schools. You then add in the transfer portal that allows players to shop their services from one school to another to the highest bidder. And you have essentially no great backups that are going to be left at positions, because a guy on the bench who thinks he can get playing time and increases NIL money somewhere else is going to go there. Then you couple in these deadlines for recruiting and no windows for coaching hiring, and you get situations like Lane Kiffin forced to make a decision on whether he wants to coach his team into the playoffs and on a national championship run or take a dream job at LSU. And now that you have a 12-team playoff, which everyone seemed to think was going to be better than any of the systems they've used in the past to determine who is the national champion in college football, but all of those things combined with the 12-team playoff has team after team after team refusing bowl bids now and ending up with teams with winning records saying, no, we don't want to participate in the bowl because we have a new coach, because our players don't want to get hurt because they're going into the draft or the transfer portal. No, we don't want to do that because it's a meaningless game. Or no, we don't want to do that for whatever other reason. And now you have team after team after team refusing to go to a bowl that they're invited to. So you have teams with losing records now going into the bowls. And it's all a big, fat mess. And I know everyone's got a different idea how to fix it and what should be done next. But bottom line is, for now, it really is a mess. But that having been said, people still love college football. Fans still are going to watch college football and love watching college football. And regardless of how many teams are in the playoffs or who's participating in bowls, there's going to be interest. There's going to be people watching and listening to games on television and radio or streaming games, and there's going to be an audience. But it all, of course, is going to come down to the money and who has the money, who wants the money, and who can get the money to determine how ultimately this ends up. I don't know what the future holds. The one thing that has been constant in college football is everything changes, and they keep trying a new system, and it keeps making it messier and muddier. Will they find one that cleans it up and makes it more streamlined and better for all? I don't know. But as we like to say in radio, stay tuned. Call me now, 504-260-1870, if you have ideas on this. Also want to talk to you, before Tim Brando was able to join us on the radio, I was introducing or talking about the topic about how the vast majority of Americans do not love their job. The vast majority of Americans either hate or just don't care for their job. And to me, that is a disaster. I want to hear from you at 504-260-1870. If you hate your job, if you work with people who hate your job, if you're a supervisor and you have employees who hate their jobs or are just disengaged and don't care about their jobs, I want to talk about it. And if you have a solution, let me know at 504-260-1870 on how we fix this. Because overwhelmingly, 69% of Americans are not loving their jobs. Should you love your job? Does that make sense? Is that the ideal? Can you love your job? Let's continue the conversation. We also have Senator John Kennedy joining us in a few minutes after we check on WWL traffic. New report says 41% of Americans feel stuck in their jobs, and 69% of the American workforce is either not engaged or is actively disengaged from their work. They don't like or they don't love or even like their jobs. They just kind of show up. Dixie, thanks for calling. You're on WWL. What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, my thought is this. We need to force Congress to do something about the health insurance crisis. This should not be a problem in this country. We're the richest country in the world. Why on earth are we held captive by these insurance companies? And it just breaks my heart that these people cannot move out of something that they hate because they're afraid their insurance is, they won't have any insurance.
Yeah, 50% of people surveyed said they would love to start their own business. They'd love to work for themselves, but they can't because they can't afford the insurance. They need their boss to pay part of their insurance premiums.
Yeah, and they're probably very creative people. Look at what they could offer the economy for themselves and for the rest of the country, you know, like you see on ABC News, you know, they have the thing about Buy America and they show all these people with these different, you know, a soap company or making jams and jellies and things like that. And they're happy people.
As long as they're healthy and don't need health insurance, apparently. But we lost Dixie. Sorry, the call dropped there. But Dixie, the question is then, what is the solution and what do we do about what do we do to get people affordable health care? And that's one of the things we can talk about with U.S. Senator John Kennedy, who's joining us now on the live line. Good morning, Senator Kennedy. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Same to you, Dave. Thanks for having me, man.
Glad that you're here. Let's start there. I was going to talk to you about immigration first, but since we're kind of transitioning here, let's start there because I know that that has been kind of the topic of the day there on the Hill, particularly for the Senate, talking about the future of the Affordable Care Act, health care subsidies, and what is the solution to giving Americans access to affordable health care if not keeping these subsidies in place for the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare?
Well, if I were king for a day, I'm not, and I don't aspire to be. Here's what I would do to help the 24 million people who get their health care through the exchanges, which, of course, is a small percentage of Americans, but nonetheless important. To reduce the cost of health care, we could pass a bill requiring what's called site neutrality, which means you pay the same price for a procedure in the hospital as you do in an outpatient clinic. Right now, we pay more if you get the service in a hospital. That makes absolutely no difference. Number two, the subsidies that you talk about right now, that we have right now, are paid directly by the federal government to the insurance companies. There's an enormous amount of fraud, just enormous amount of fraud in the billions. I would change the law to provide that the money goes from the federal government to the patient, to the people, and they get to decide which insurance program they want to buy, not just sending the money to the insurance companies. Those would be two of the things that I would do almost immediately. The third thing I would do is we have an executive order that provides this, but hospitals aren't complying. Hospitals need to post their prices so people can shop around. They're required to do it, but a lot of hospitals don't comply.
Yeah, that's always a huge mystery. You never know when you're going in for a medical procedure or a hospitalization or whatever. You have no idea what it's going to cost you in the end, whether you have insurance or not, whether you have Medicare or Medicaid or not, whether you have whatever your situation. You really do have no idea what it's going to cost. You just have to wait for that bill and then, you know, get pie-eyed because it's always much larger than you ever thought it could be.
Well, if you went into Costco tomorrow and you bought a bunch of stuff, and you went to check out and they said, okay, that's great. We're not going to tell you what you got to pay. We'll tell you in about 6 weeks. But you can take the stuff home. But if you don't pay in 6 weeks, whatever we tell you, we're going to bankrupt you. Nobody would buy anything from Costco, but that's how we do healthcare. Doesn't make any sense.
Is there any model you like for universal healthcare or providing public healthcare to all Americans?
Well, we have almost universal health care now. Most people get their health care through their employer. We have a large portion of people who get their health care through Medicaid if their income is low enough. And we have a large portion of people who get their health care through Medicare, the elderly. There's a group, I think it's 10 to maybe 15%, who don't fall into any of those three groups, that were allowed under Obamacare to go onto an exchange and buy insurance with the federal government's help. And we were told if we would do that, that health insurance for those 24 million people would be cheaper and it would be more accessible. And it's been neither. We were told it would make our lives better. It's made our lives worse. And it's now time to fix the exchanges for those 24 million people. For those 24 million people, we are spending $350 billion over a 10-year period. It's outrageous. I mean,
what's the alternative? What do we do instead?
Just, you can keep the exchanges, but you have to reform how we're delivering the care. Stop sending the money directly to the insurance company. Send it to people. Reform your billing practices. Require transparency. Get serious about the fraud. There is an enormous amount of fraud. GAO just came out with a report day before yesterday. There's an enormous amount of fraud in the billions of dollars that we know how to stop. We just have to pass legislation to do it.
We found
people, dead people, who have signed up for these subsidies. I mean, it's just nobody's checking.
Talking with U.S. Senator John Kennedy, let's shift topics now to the immigration crackdown we're seeing here in Louisiana, with U.S. Border Patrol sending some 250 agents to try and round up reportedly some 5,000 illegal immigrants in the region, which would be between 5% and 10% of the reported illegal immigrants around here. Your thoughts on the coverage we've seen of this and the operation itself?
Under federal law, which is supreme under Article 6 of the Constitution, legal immigration is legal, and illegal immigration is illegal. Legally, we bring in 1 million of our world's neighbors every year. They're properly vetted, more than any other country. But we have a lot of folks during the last administration, between 8 and 12 million, who came in illegally, and we don't have the slightest idea of who they are. The last administration, federal administration, did not enforce federal law. The Trump administration is. And it sent in, I think, 250, 300 agents to New Orleans. Many of them are now in Baton Rouge to enforce federal law. They've arrested, I'm told, around 50 people in New Orleans, among the most serious criminals. They arrested a guy named Jorge Vieira Serrano of Cuba, who was convicted of forcible rape and is in our country illegally. Ben Von To of Vietnam, he has a rap sheet as long as your arm. He was in our country illegally. Anthony Jose Soraya Gutierrez of Nicaragua, he's a member of the 18th Street Gang. He's in our country illegally. And we have arrested, those are three of the worst. And they will be arrested, have been arrested, and they will be deported. That's federal law. Some people don't like it, but if you don't like federal law, you should change it, not just not follow it.
There's been a lot of criticism of the tactics that the Border Patrol agents are using. The Associated Press put out a report that only a handful of the people detained were these actual worst of the worst criminals. Any response to those who have been critical of what they believe are overhanded tactics by Border Patrol and the Associated Press report that they're really not going after just the bad criminals? They're going after people who are here illegally without rap sheets.
No, I think that's true. I think when you're in our country illegally, you're violating federal law. It's a crime. Now, the agents are primarily looking for criminals. But if they come across someone who's not a criminal, who doesn't have a rap sheet, but he's in our country illegally, which is a violation of federal law, they're not just going to ignore them. And so I don't know where this started, where people said, oh, they're only going to arrest people who are really, really, really bad. Well, they're trying to get those folks, but they're also trying to enforce federal immigration law as well. And look, the agents are required to follow due process, including the standard of reasonable suspicion. If they don't, people are certainly entitled to file a 1983 action in court. But most of the frankly, Dave, most of the allegations that I've heard of federal agents violating the law are coming from people, local elected officials, who just believe that we ought to have open borders. And they're entitled to have that belief, but that's not federal law.
Senator John Kennedy is our guest for just a couple more minutes. He's got to run, and we do too. So let me ask you quickly. The government was shut down for the longest period ever earlier this year. Mm-hmm. There are fears that the stopgap measure that opened it up again will lead to another shutdown in January. Do you see the government shutting down again? And are conversations amongst you and your colleagues to prevent that from happening, you think, going to be successful?
I hope so. The choice to shut down government was from my Democratic colleagues. I voted 14 times to open it up. They voted 14 times to keep it shut down until they finally did. We have another deadline, January 30th. I can assure you I will vote to keep government open, but I can't tell you, Dave, how anybody else will vote, including my Democratic friends.
Senator Kennedy, we sure appreciate, we know your time is valuable, and I sure appreciate your sharing some of it with us here. Anything else you want to say before we let you run?
No, thanks, Dave. You're a damn good news director and reporter.
Well, I appreciate that. You have a fantastic holiday season. Enjoy your Christmas and your new year.
Thanks, man.
Senator Bye. John Kennedy with us here on WWL. Back with Newell next.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second, and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detecttheSOS.com to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This holiday season, choose gifts that feel thoughtful and practical with Omaha Steaks. Whether you're hosting or gifting, they deliver the world's best steak experience, and it makes you look like you planned way ahead. They've got USDA-certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, comfort meals, and tons more. Gifting Omaha Steaks is honestly one of the easiest wins. Everything arrives beautifully packaged, super convenient, and the quality is unbelievable. Their filet mignons are some of the most tender I've ever had, and the variety means you can personalize every gift. Plus, orders placed by 6 p.m. Eastern ship same day, and everything is backed by their 100% guarantee. It's holiday gifting made simple. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Sizzle All The Way sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code T-Bone at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, code T-Bone.